Welcome to Our Beer Could Be Your Life. This week, we talked to Justin Kelly of Sons of Southern Ulster about all things Ireland. It was a rollicking and interesting conversation about beer, about what it's like to grow up in the backcountry of Ireland, about a band called Horse Lips, and about a bunch of interesting music that I've never heard before. How you doing, man?
Doing good. We also learned what culties are. You're going to have to find out what a culty is, which I thought was an interesting term. But I am doing good today. Just drinking a beer on a Friday afternoon as we record our intro here, which is delightful.
Yeah, happy Friday. Yeah, we got Real Dennis in this episode, too. It's kind of the debut of Real Deep Dennis O'Donovan, I think that was great.
He was so excited.
Anytime Ireland comes up, I kind of have to interject myself. I can't help it, in my blood.
Yeah, quite literally, right? I mean, and it was interesting because I think we learned in the episode and talking to Justin that, you know, you and I have a very different perspective on our heritage. I also have Irish heritage and had a desire to learn more about it as a kid, and my parents were just like, no. They didn't care about it, they didn't know about it, and they didn't care to pass it along, which is, you know, a totally valid thing in a city full of Irish Catholics as Boston is.
I think it's a little different for people like myself, who two of my grandparents are from Ireland, and I was pretty close with them growing up. And the Irish Americans that have some connection to Ireland, like a family connection to Ireland, tend to be obsessed with Ireland, like I am. You know, those that don't have a connection don't seem to really be as obsessed with it, which I've always found interesting.
Yeah, you know, my uncle, my dad and his two brothers, right? One of them, well, they all had a grandfather from Ireland who they knew, and one of them, of the three, has traveled, met family, like gotten really into it. And the other two are just like very literal minded people who are just like, well, I was born in the US and that's all I cared to. That's all, yeah. I cared to know. And one of them raised me. So that here we are.
Yeah. And something I found interesting was talking to Justin about, you know, he emigrated here and he's talking about how he doesn't really like going to Irish pubs, because like he doesn't want to be reminded of home. He left home to get away from there. And I can like relate to that, because my grandmother, when I was 18, I wanted to move to Ireland. And she thought I was the most insane person she had ever met. Like she came here to get out of there. And, you know, it's not this, like, it wasn't this romanticized land for her. It was this like, kind of like a hellscape she escaped from, and she couldn't understand my fascination with Ireland. She was all about being an American, and she thought I was crazy for wanting to go to Ireland.
Yeah, they left for a reason. They came here and this was the better place to them. And they probably, you know, haven't seen as Ireland possibly has grown and maybe is a different place now that, you know, they could go back to, but that's not the way they're looking at it. It's gone. Rearview mirror.
Yeah. Ireland has for sure changed. And my grandmother wasn't really there to see that change. But it's definitely different now.
That seedy underbelly, though, is kind of the inspiration for a lot of the songs that Justin has written for Songs of Southern Ulster. And so we like definitely got into some of the abuse and mischief and all the crazy things that he grew up around and ended up leaving. And I think you know, it's interesting to talk to anybody who's got age and wisdom on you, and have them kind of talk about what it was like growing up in that place, how it was challenging and was tough, but that he doesn't wish that, you know, he's happy that he had that experience, and he's happy to be able to go back and look at it now and, you know, share that experience. I really kind of connected with some of the stuff he was talking about just by virtue of, you know, I live 30 minutes from the town that I went to high school, town where you and I both went to high school, Dennis, right? And I was in that town the day we recorded this episode, with drunks at bars shouting at me at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, because they're like, oh, you work for a brewery, give me a t-shirt. Yeah. I was like, yeah, man, thanks. Have a nice day. Like those people he's talking about having grown up near. I'm like, yeah, those people exist in suburban Massachusetts as well. I can confirm they are around.
They sure are.
Yeah.
It's a little funny because he talks about, you know, growing up in Ireland, but he's glad he like picked Acton to live in because his kids can go to a good school. And like, it's such a, you know, contrast of just like going to probably, I'm guessing, a school that was, you know, religiously affiliated that he probably ended up going to, as opposed to just like, got to make sure my kids get the best education here. Like, it's such a different world now.
Yeah. Well, it was a very different conversation than the ones you had thus far. And the records are both great. And I'm really excited that we got a chance to speak to him. And the funny local connection was that, I was just trolling some Irish music and found these guys and wanted to reach out to see if they had vinyl and saw that they were based in Acton, Massachusetts. And that's started a conversation, ended up in this this very loose conversation we had last night after that little scheduling snafu we had. And we got a chance to get nice and relaxed before we talked to Justin. I think that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. I drank plenty of Irish stout before that started.
Yeah. Yeah. But so for Friday, what I'm going to introduce what I'm drinking before we get to the episode. I'm drinking actually Draft Lab beer, which is something we do at work to ensure the quality of beer. I've got a shipping out of Boston from Jack's Abbey that has meets specs and is keeping the thirst slaked for the afternoon. What do you guys got?
I've got an O'Hara's Irish Red. Since we're introducing the our Irish podcast here, so yeah, I figured I'd go with the O'Hara's Irish Red, probably my favorite Irish brewery.
I am drinking some Idle Hands Gretel, nice pilsner from probably my favorite brewery that I don't work for in Massachusetts, up in Malden. I think Chris and his team up there just make some great beer. Stopped there before band practice.
Great. Well, stick around and listen to some really strange stories about backcountry cabin in Bailabra, Ireland, and us drinking beer with Justin. Enjoy.
Jumpers, filled to the brim with glee and mischief, belting out with abandon, without inhibition, to a world as yet unexplored.
Justin, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. How's it going?
It's been going good. We've been hanging out, drinking our beers.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, I was just hanging out here. I thought it was 8:30, but did I have it wrong?
We had it for 7, but we've just been catching up. And
I'm sorry. I'm so okay. Sorry. I thought it was 8:30 for some reason.
No, it's all right. It's all right.
We're
cycling in and out for beers right now. So this is Dennis.
How are you doing?
Hey, Dennis. How are you?
Good.
Sorry for keeping you guys waiting. I don't know why I thought it was 8:30.
It's okay.
To be honest, I was just hanging out on the couch, half asleep.
Well, don't tell us that. You were hard at work.
Sorry. Yeah, I was rocking out. I was picking up hell here.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
I'm going to go grab a Murphy's. I'll be right back. Here's Matt Oz in the chat.
That's what I'm drinking too.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
Perfect. Cilantro.
Cilantro.
I already finished my Murphy's, so now I'm moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have to have that. You can't just have one Murphy's.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
True.
Yeah. Justin, I've been, listening to your stuff, and I watched your documentary My grandfather is from a town not super far away from Ballybro. He's from Glenfarne in County Leitrim.
Oh yeah, is that where? Is that there? I think there's a famous ballroom or there, like where people used to go dancing, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be very much be very similar to the lifestyle that we would have had in Ballybro. It was that kind of rural, kind of part of the country that would be considered not cool. Like yeah. it was kind of a backwater, and we were very much. Yeah. I'm trying to, what's the word here? Like kind of redneck or something. In Ireland, yeah. we were called culchies. Culchies, yeah. which was a real derogatory term. It sounds kind of funny now, but it was a real put down from the big city slickers, you know?
Yeah.
Culchies like sounds like what my uncle would call me as someone who like is a little pinko communism guy or something like that. Like that's what he thinks an insult is. Look at this little culchie. So thinks he's cultured.
Yeah, well, no, it has nothing to do with culture. It's like an old Irish word, and it had to do with sort of being kind of lumpen and country and having a certain type of accent and not being cool and not being part of the pale. The pale being the old word for Dublin, where Dublin was sort of like the center of sort of culture in Ireland for many years. It was, you know, where the British Empire sort of was centered in the country for a while. So, you know, people outside were... you know, I don't want to say looked down upon, with, you know, in really, really badly. Yeah. But there were a couple of counties that were just so left behind, and Cavan and Leitrim and Monaghan were those counties.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandfather had an incredibly thick Leitrim accent until like he never lost it. Yeah.
Well, to be honest, I actually spent my early years in Dublin. And we moved to Cavan when I was about 11 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I hated it. It was like, it was a big culture shock. It was a 50 mile trip down the road, but it was like a different world.
Yeah.
And I really resented it. It's only later on in life that I sort of began to go, yeah, that was actually quite interesting. It was quite, I was quite privileged really to sort of move out of a boring suburb of a typical city to this place where there was all sorts of sort of mischief to get up to.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was 13, I went to my grandmother's from rural County Cork. And we got to see the little cottage she grew up in with, you know, 16 brothers and sisters. And like I was 13 at the time. My biggest complaint was like, I had the smaller of the two bedrooms. And it's like, oh yeah, your grandmother grew up in a 4-room shack with 16 brothers and sisters. Like, what are you crying about, Dennis? Yeah.
Well, that's children for you. I have the same problems with my kids. They don't know how privileged they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
They got to spend $1,000 to show you how much better you have it. Like that's just the cost of showing you.
Yeah. Well, I kind of have I'm my kids kind of complain about their lives, and I kind of want to secretly say the only reason we live in Acton is because of you lot. We're here for the schools. I think they think I like this kind of lifestyle. So it's not bad, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the dream.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you spending some time with us. We've been talking a lot about the records and you. We've collectively watched the documentary and spent a lot of time reading about what you guys have done. And I think it's a really cool story. So I'm really appreciating you sharing some of it with us.
Well, thanks. Absolutely. And thanks for picking up on it. To be honest, it's our, you know, this is very much something that we sort of do in Ireland. And even though I live here, I have a job and I go to work every day, and it's kind of my secret life. And so the album's taken off a bit in Ireland and slightly in the UK, but we haven't really done anything over here. And there was always a worry that people over here wouldn't really get what we're doing because it's so rooted in, you know, small town Ireland. But it actually seems that people kind of do get what we're doing. So
yeah, you're telling some interesting stories and vignettes in the songs, right? And we were one of the things that kind of struck me. I said I wasn't going to say this to you because I was like, I don't want to like seem like I'm flattering him. But when you read certain like old English, so I would say reading Shakespeare, for example, if you try to read it on the page, is obtuse and it's hard to pick up. But if you like open your mind to it and you like hear contextually some of the language, it starts to fit and it starts to make more sense. And you're telling some interesting stories that have to do, it seems like, with like, I don't know, transitions from rural places to industrial places and out of industrial spaces into, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of interesting transition, it seems like you're picking up on in these songs.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And certainly the second album, Sinners and Lost Souls, that very much deals with that sort of an Ireland that was sort of beginning to change. Ireland changed very slowly. Like when I left Ireland 30 years ago, and it was a very different country when I lived there. It was very backward, and it was almost like what America would have been like in the 1950s. But the wheels of change were beginning to turn. But it was also, there's a tendency with the Sun songs and with people who listen to what we do to sort of think that we're singing about this kind of, you know, idyllic time. And it really wasn't an idyllic time. It was actually when you scratch the surface of the Ireland of the 70s and the 60s and you know, those times of the 80s. It was quite a horrific society in so far as there was all this institutionalized sort of, I don't want to say brutality, but sort of institutionalized injustice that was accepted from the government to the church, to the way the schools were run. And it was a very dark place. Now you could sort of within those strict sort of parameters, you could have fun and you could get drunk and you could smoke cigarettes and you could do all those things and be crazy and stay out till 1 o'clock in the morning when you were like 11 years old and nobody cared. But there was this insidious side to what was going on. And there was a lot of corruption and there was a lot of, you know, you hear about it now with like the whole child molestation from the church and all of that kind of stuff. So it really wasn't. So in some ways it was idyllic as a child to grow up there. But in looking back, it's quite horrific to sort of see the society that many people were sort of forced to live in. And the choices were slim. Like, that's why there were so many of us emigrated. There was just nothing to do. And you sort of get to a certain age. Like, I was there. I left Ireland in my mid-20s. And there was just nothing for me. There was nothing. It was just, I had no prospects whatsoever. And it was just a case of hopping on a plane one day and coming here. And never going home. And that's the way it was for so many people. So I think Ireland's better now. Of course, it seemed to get better as soon as I left. That's the story.
By way of, I guess, introducing the band, you Sons of Southern Ulster have put out two records. The first one in, was it 2015?
It was early 2016, I think. Yeah.
And
to be honest, I can't remember. We didn't realize anyone would listen, so we weren't sure. So it depends.
Joe, what do we take notes for?
I don't.
Come on.
I'm sorry. that record seems to deal a lot with like more of a youthful perspective on your growing up, and it actually the I think the last song on it, which is eponymous Sons of Southern Ulster, seems to talk about that movement of human beings out of that space.
Absolutely, and that album was really I think what you sort of, that album was our first foray into this world, into this Southern Sons of Southern Ulster thing. And I think when we started creating songs, or we started putting songs together, myself and the other guys in the band, we've known each other for years, even though I've been over here for 30 years or thereabouts. We've known each other a long time, and we were in a band together like years ago.
Oh, we want to ask about the Panic Merchants, but we've done some homework.
you've done your homework. So we've been in this band, and the band we were in, you know, it was of its time, and it was okay. But when we decided we wanted to write songs again, it became very apparent that nobody would be interested in a bunch of 50-year-olds, or I think we were like in our late 40s then, but we're in our 50s now. Nobody, you know, we weren't going to try and write songs and kind of like, let's be like, Oasis or something, or yeah, it just seemed pure Ireland, vacuous, and there's other people who do it better. So we sort of thought that, you know, I've been listening to a few bands that sort of, you know, sing about, you know, places and are of their place, and I very consciously wanted to sort of examine this world of Cavan, where nobody ever really sang about Cavan. Like, there's no pop, oddly enough, no, since then there have been a couple of pop bands from Cavan. But at that time, there were none. And it was just this dull place. And it never was in movies or, you know, and whenever anyone wrote books about it, it was just all this depressing stuff about dads beating their kids and everyone dying sadly in the end and that kind of stuff. So I just thought it was worth looking into it. So I really, the lens was really solidly placed on this town, Balibre. And so you find that the songs, they're kind of pastoral in a way, and they're just sort of there's a lot of describing the town and sort of putting myself back into that time of, you know, growing up there and describing it. And then, of course, you know, there's a few characters that, you know, people who are from the town who listen to the albums, they kind of get onto me and they go, oh, that's so-and-so you're talking about, and that's so-and-so, which is a little worrying sometimes, but nobody's gotten too put out by it yet. But the first album was more passive, I suppose, in many ways. It was a kind of commentary on growing up in a small town. And I don't want to put things in. I hate ranty protest music that is just all this is bad and all this is good. I just hate that stuff, because my experience is life isn't black and white. It's kind of various shades of gray. And so what I didn't want to do is I didn't want to say, well, we grew up in this town, it was shitty or it was great. Or I just wanted to kind of say, let's not be too judgmental here, but occasionally, you know, you throw something in and that sort of makes you kind of think. And I, you know, like, for example, we had a song about McAlarney Says, which was about going down to the lake and all this kind of stuff. But it also talked of suicide, which was very prevalent in that part of Ireland at that time. But I wanted to do it in a kind of respectful way. I didn't want it sort of, you know, there's enough bands out there talking about how hard they had it and how it sucked and everyone was small-minded and they couldn't wait to get away. And so I think we probably captured that quite well. And then with the second album, we came to the second album, it's probably a little bit more judgmental. It's a little bit telling tales about, you know, it deals with, you know, there's a lot of stuff there. And, you know, there's a whole thing of alcohol that runs through the band and drinking. And alcohol was rampant when I was growing up. It was just, you started drinking when you were about 13 and that was it. And you started smoking then. And alcoholism was rampant, and, you know, violence and depression and all of the things that you associate with heavy drinking, they really were quite rampant. And so you have to sort of talk about those things. So, you know, so it's probably a little more judgmental and a little bit more caustic, I suppose, than the first album.
I think caustic is fair. I think the sound of it's darker too. It definitely has like a very rich kind of musical world that's framing the lyrical content that's a little bit, it's just a little bit edgier and darker than the first album, I think. And I think it also kind of tracks that youthful picture in the first one to a little bit more of an acerbic, sharp picture of this place.
Yeah, sonically,
I would agree with that.
Like sonically, I think that the newer record sounds like it's blistering, but it's got some heavy ass, like, you know, the guitar and that stuff is like, from a tone, I play guitar, and as a tone person, like the tone of that guitar, whoever produced that sound, I'm just like, give me that. Like, it just sounds so good. That whoever produced your record deserves however much money you can give them and more, because it sounds amazing. Well, and just like, you know, you get like the way that you sort of, you go back and forth between almost like, you know, talking, singing over on the top of it. And you talk about telling these stories. It does feel like you're like being able to look from afar and like just explain a situation, explain a life. and there's positives and negatives. Like, it just, it came out so good.
Well, I think the music is a you're right to point to the producer, but he was a guy called Dara Dukes. But David, who plays the guitar, he's kind of the musical person of the band. He holds the whole thing together musically. So David's been playing guitar for, well, he's mid-50s, probably been playing since he was about 20. So, you know, 35 years, and then he stopped in the middle. But I think David's now sort of at a point where he was a frustrated guitarist. And, you know, I think when he was in his younger days, when we used to play in bands together, you know, he would play the guitar, but I think he always thought he could be better. And I think the time sort of came that this was the right time. And of course, you want to be 22 when this right time comes along, but life steps in the way. And, you know, he's been practicing there for a long time. And I think he puts a lot of work into the guitar sound. And he's very, you know, he's really worked hard on that. And I think on this album, he really wanted to get that harder edge out, because, you know, we're kind of essentially at the end of it. When you strip it all away, we're all punk rockers. And we wanted to sort of get that kind of heavier guitar sound than on the first album. So there's more confidence on the second album. And David's more assured. When we were doing the first album musically, it was all recorded remotely. And we really didn't know what we were doing. And we were just experimenting. So I think there was a bit more confidence the second time around. And David's guitar style has just, he's really good now. And Dara Dukes, then the producer, that's a guy we just kind of came across. He lives in Limerick in Ireland. And he's an old band guy too. And Dara's great. He brings a total new level to the songs. But it must be torture for him producing us, because we're very opinionated. So every time he does something that he thinks is good and he runs it by us, 9 times out of 10, we go, yeah, it's great, but can you kind of go back to the way it was? And there's this kind of fighting between us, like friendly fighting between us, that goes on over months and months, because we do this stuff slowly. We're not, you know, this isn't, you know, we're not, in, we're, it happens over time. And Dara's very patient with us, and I don't know how he puts up with us, but he's a musician himself. He produces his own stuff. And, you know, he used to be in Irish bands back in the day when, you know, there was a Limerick scene when bands like the Cranberries and stuff came out, and Dara was sort of on the cusp of this wave. And so he's very clued in. He's very astute. He's a little younger than us. And I think sometimes that's that comes across, in that we're coming from different times. And I think where Dara really helps us is occasionally he just says, cut the bullshit here. Because if we had our way, everything would be up to 11 all the time, and I'd just be roaring and screaming, and we'd be kind of like Black Flag or something. And there's nothing wrong with Black Flag, but in fact, I love Black Flag. But, you know, that's Dara stopped us from, he protects us from ourselves and from our instincts, and we're very fortunate to have him. He's done both the albums. He's produced both albums.
Well, you have a very very unique sound, and I think that actually the dynamics of it are a big part of that. I think Matt was just saying that, between the talking to the singing to the roar, and the fact that you can live in all those spaces and still tell the stories. I think it's really it's really effective in painting a picture of a place I've never been to, and had no idea before stumbling across your music, you know, that this kind of interstitial area between North and Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and like these two times and places that you're kind of like talking about. I think it's really, really fascinating. And I kind of want to talk about the town though, because the town is like a character in these records. And you've said, so Bailarbrough is a town of 2,000 people and 30 pubs. And you moved there when you were 11.
32. I think there was 32 at the height.
Got it.
And I should say too, that, When we moved, I think I said earlier that we moved to the town when I was about 11 years old. And it was actually my father's hometown. He grew up there. And obviously he left, and we came back. We'd sort of fallen on hard times. And, you know, my father didn't have a job, and there'd been a lot. There'd been a, it's another day I could tell you this story, but there'd been a big court case, and my father was charged with heinous crimes and everything else, which he was found not guilty of. But we sort of retreated back to Bailiborough to sort of lick our wounds. We'd no money. But at that time, you could buy property in Cavan cheap. And we had this like sort of suburban house in Dublin, and they were able to sell that and purchase a bar in Bailiborough. So we moved into a pub, and it was a pub that my father's father had owned 40 years before or 30 years before. So it was a huge lifestyle change. And as a child, I went from being this kind of a very, you know, closeted child in a suburban setting in Dublin to living upstairs from a bar. And it wasn't one of the fancy bars. It was like, you know, sawdust. There wasn't actual sawdust on the floor, but it was rough and ready. And we got, you know, it was the roughest people in the town with, like, you know, a lot of fights and a lot of things would go on, and probably a lot of alcoholics in retrospect, like guys who'd be sitting at the counter from, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 9 o'clock in the evening, and then they'd go home and all the money spent and that kind of thing. So I kind of got to see it from that side of the counter. And then because there were 32 pubs, as kids, like the entertainment, I make it sound very dark and depressing, but there were good kids in the town who played football and played tennis and did all those things. I wasn't one of those. I always gravitated towards the people who didn't do that.
Sure.
So what we would do for entertainment during the day is we just hang around the town and we'd go into the bars. And, you know, before you'd start drinking, you'd go into the bars and it was considered cool, and you'd play pool and you'd play on their jukebox and you'd just hang around and you'd be listening to serious losers telling story, like, you'd know them. They, and you know, so the society then, I think, was less sort of things were more available. Like, you'd know, like, growing up in a small town in Ireland, you'd have relationships with, like, my kids nowadays in Acton, Massachusetts, the only other people they really know are people that are their own age or they go to school with. When I was 11 years old in Cavan, I was, I don't want to say friendly, but I would know and have conversations on a daily basis with, like, fully grown men who drank 10 pints of beer every day. And so it just gave you a different perspective. The pub was really a big part of growing up. Like, you know, the fact that there were 32 pubs in this tiny town, it really was an important part of growing up. And, I think there's a sort of a romanticization, I suppose, of the Irish pub, and especially here in America, where, you know, people stick a shamrock in the window and go, "Hey, it's an Irish pub." And, you know, they weren't all like that. They were much more, you know, when the 32 pubs weren't all like the Burren in Davis Square. They were, half of them were like, they were more like Sligo's.
We're like Sligo's, yeah.
And no offense to Sligo's, but it was kind of rough and ready. And, you know, there'd be a couple of fancier ones, like the glitterati from the town might drink in the local hotel or something. They'd be afraid of going to the other pubs or to our pub. But it was certainly a big thing. It was a big thing growing up, and, you know, not just for drinking, but socializing and hanging out. And I remember, you know, there was a pub up the street and we played pool, and they had a bookie shop next to it. And, you know, if you had a bit of money, you could go in and you put a bet on the horses and stuff. All this kind of stuff that kids don't get to do anymore. And probably for good reason.
I was saying, I'm sure you could teach your children to bet online if you wanted them to have access to bookies. I'm sure you can get some.
Yeah, I'm sure I could. But luckily, the betting never really, you know, I did it occasionally for kicks, but it never really was something that would appeal to me. So,
what was there a music scene in this town?
There was a music scene, but not the music scene that we wanted. It was a music scene very much Ireland in the late 70s and the early 80s was very much in the grip of what was called a show band era. And basically that would be bands like they consisted of like 7 or 8 guys. It was invariably guys. Usually, there might be a woman at the front of some of them or a backing vocalist, but it was usually guys. And there'd be 7 or 8 guys in the band, and they'd wear suits and they'd all look the same, and they would be fantastic musicians. And they would learn the hits of, you know, whatever was in the charts in America or was in the charts in Britain. And they'd just go around Ireland 7 nights a week playing to packed dance halls. That was the biggest music in Ireland. And with that, there was a huge country and Western scene. country and Western music was absolutely Charlie Pride and Johnny Cash and all of that stuff. It was absolutely huge. And it was so big that when I went to Nashville about 5 years ago, I went to Nashville for something and I ended up in the Country Music Hall of Fame. And it was like stepping back to Baylor in 1977, because it was all those artists and all those big flared pants and high heel shoes. And that was the thing. So that was really the main thing. So like bands didn't really come to our town that we would be particularly interested in. There were a couple that would come. There was a band from Ireland called Horselips, and Horselips, don't laugh, they were a Celtic rock band. And they were actually really good. Like you should look them up. They were actually really good. And they, for some reason, would tour around. So they would come to our town. And in fact, we wrote a song about one of the gigs. So there was a big fight and people were throwing chairs and stuff and somebody got knocked out. And it's on the first album. But Horselips were kind of our saviors. And then the other thing that we had was British music was piped into our houses. We had the BBC. And every week there'd be a show called Top of the Pops. So the whole punk scene was happening at that time. So we were privy to it from a distance. But, you know, it's not like the Sex Pistols would have ever made it to Baileyburgh and even Ireland. Because I remember around 1978 or 79, there was an Irish band called the Boomtown Rats who'd kind of made it. But they'd had a number one hit single in Britain. And they came back to Ireland to do this triumphant tour. And all the priests and the police and stuff got together and said, no, we don't want you playing this because it's, you know, kind of subversive. And they were kind of, they didn't do it in the end. And they wrote a song about it later called Banana Republic. And so it was a kind of weird thing because you had access to this punk music and that kind of stuff, but it was kind of distant. And so you were sort of in this juxtaposition that you'd never go to see a band that were any good, or that, you know, that you'd be seeing these show bands and stuff, and you'd sort of go to them and you just deal with it, you know. It was just the way it was. Sure. So
it must be.
So when did you start making music? Was this around that same time, or
this? I would say the music was a little later. It was sort of in our late teens. And we very much made it in the sort of punk rock ethos. You know, we'd read all this stuff that you don't need to be able to play your instruments and all that kind of stuff. And so when we started, we actually couldn't play our instruments and we were dreadful. And, but we didn't care. We were more into the idea of it. We were very arrogant. And, but we didn't really play around the town that much. We would play mainly in Dublin. There was a sort of a scene in Dublin where there was, you know, some nascent bands there. That, you know, U2 had sort of made it around 1979 or 1980, and suddenly everyone thought everyone was going, you know, Dublin was full of U2.
I heard of those guys.
And sadly, it kind of was full of U2, you know, guys with like ponytails and mullets and stuff, you know, singing, kind of trying to be like Bono and stuff. But there was a little scene, so there were various bars you could play, and it was, there were some good bands coming out of Dublin at the time. It was like the Virgin Prunes were very experimental, and then, you know, bands like A House and stuff, and they were pretty good. So, but that would have been a bit later, and we sort of did that for a few years, but it was just very much a hobby. And then at some point it got kind of boring, and it kind of lost interest and totally forgot about music for, you know, 25 years. It didn't, when I came to America, I didn't even, you know, after a while, I sort of forgot I was ever in a band. And it was years later, my mother passed away and my sister had come over after my mother had died. And she had a box of tapes of the old band and, you know, cassette tapes. And one week I decided, oh, I'd digitize these and send them to the guys who used to be in the band. It'd be kind of funny. And as I was listening to them, most of it, I have to admit, was absolute shit. And occasionally you come across a little nugget that, yeah, there's a good little bit there. So as we were listening to it, you know the way it is. You'd be listening to it now, having drinks and stuff. And next thing we were going, we weren't bad at all. And that sort of made us think about doing this thing. But I think there was this, and I suspect this is probably common in people who were in bands who didn't make it, that there was always this itch that needed to be scratched, that there was something left. And in our minds, we'd sort of, we'd always read it. We'd never put out a 7-inch single. And we sort of wanted to do that. So that was kind of part of our thinking. So we're quite immature in many ways.
Well, and fast forwarding to now, you have Pete Briquette remixing a single off of your last album. Isn't he connected to the Boomtown Rats in some way, making a big circle here from where you are now?
Yeah, well, that is remarkable because not only is Pete Briquette from the Boomtown Rats, but he's also from Cavan, which is where Bailiwer is. And when we were kids and the Boomtown Rats kind of made it, we kind of heard on the grapevine that the bass player, Pete Briquette, was from Cavan. So that was absolutely unheard of. So we thought that was amazing. We're very proud of it. But that was sort of as far as it went. I loved the Boomtown Rats at the time. I was absolutely obsessed with them for a couple of years. And so the Pete Briquette thing was just weird. And somebody gave him a copy of the album, or it got to him somehow. And in a very quiet and understated way, he got in touch and said he really liked it and he'd like to remix some of the tracks. So he remixed four tracks.
Cool.
And we're putting them out on an EP, like a vinyl kind of EP thing, which is coming out in a few weeks. But it was just, we were absolutely staggered. It was, you know, Pete Briquette's like, in our minds, he's like a legend. He's absolutely, you know, he's like, you know, it's like having Jello by Afro or something come up to you and go, yeah, I like your song. Or, you know, I don't know. I'm probably aging myself.
No. You know. I'm laughing thinking that Matt actually has a fairly decent Jello by Afro impression that I hear. I don't know that you can do it on a microphone.
Even don't attempt to do that.
It's not. But you've also said that you feel like you felt like you were, as the Panic Merchants, you were being subversive at the time. And now looking back, you feel like the music you're making now is truly actually subversive music in a way. I'd love to hear you talk a bit about that.
Well, I remember I'd said that in the documentary. Now, I should say about the documentary, was made by a friend of ours called Nicky Fennell, and it was made over the course of 2 days. He took all this footage as we were going around Ireland. So not everything I said was totally considered or rehearsed.
Fair.
And when I look at it now, there's parts of it where I'm like, oh, Jesus. But I think I do agree with that statement that I made. And the reason I said that was, when we were in the Panic Merchants and we were younger and trying to, we were trying to live up to something. We were playing a role. We didn't really have a voice. And we were, you know, trying to kind of, like every few months, we kind of consciously or unconsciously be trying to copy some other band that we kind of liked and go, oh, here's the, you know, let's say Nirvana. I think we broke up before Nirvana, but let's say it was Nirvana. And like, oh, here's this Nirvana riff. Let's try that. And so we were never really in charge of what we were doing. It was always kind of, we were doing this thing by numbers. And I was writing the lyrics then, and I was writing about stuff that I'd no business to be writing about. Just stupid, cliched rubbish. And, you know, sometimes you get a clever little rhyming couplet or a good verse or whatever, but it was kind of derivative nonsense. And we thought it was really heavy, you know, and cool, and we used to play live gigs, and we'd get drunk and jump around the stage, and I'd take my shirt off and stuff, and we thought we were like mad and crazy, and we were just idiots, you know, in a good way. Like, you know, I don't want to knock the whole thing. It was fun, but there was nothing really subversive about it. And what I mean by the Sons of Southern Ulster thing, I think that's more subversive because we're writing about people that never got written about in a way that they don't get written about. And you're setting yourself up for some ridicule there, or for some, you know, it's you don't know if people are going to like this stuff. But the characters that we're singing about are much more subversive than the average punk rocker. Like the men that we're talking about are sitting in a pub and they're drinking their wages up all day, and then they're going home and they might beat the wife or something. These are not nice people. And The person who goes down and he throws himself in the lake because he's so depressed, he's not a happy guy. These are way more subversive than half of the punk rockers that I remember, who were kind of living a mythical kind of existence, pretending they were drunk and drugged all the time, but really were quite conservative in many ways. So I suppose that's what I was sort of getting at when I sort of said, I think we're more, you know, we're more subversive now.
Sure.
And I think we are, because I think as you get older, you can go a couple of ways. You know, some older people become very conservative and others become, you know, growing up, I was always very conscious of what other people would think of me and, you know, what people were saying about me and this, that, and the other. You get to a point in life where you really don't give a shit. And you sort of can be, if that's subversive, where it's like, I'm just going to do what I want to do and I don't care about everybody else. And so, you know, that's the subversive part of it.
Yeah, there's a certain freedom of getting to say the things you want to say without trying to pretend to be cool, to pretend to be something. Just be yourself and like tell a story or a situation that you want to explain to somebody, and just the way it is. It's not sugarcoated. It's not covered up. You're telling a straight fucking story to somebody. And that's, you know, something that, you know, hell, I couldn't do that when I was 20. I was afraid of what somebody would think about me.
And, absolutely.
You know, but you, just, also, you grow out of that shit.
But there was a point too, in like the songs that we're singing now and the world that when we sing about Calvin or we sing about Bedivere, we're not singing about glamorous stuff. And in many ways, when we were, you know, in bands before, when we were teenagers or in our early 20s, we were kind of running away from that stuff. And I think teenagers do that. You think the place that you come from, it's uncool and it's kind of hokey and shitty, and everyone wants to move to New York City and be cool. And then you move to New York City and it's fucking shit because you're living in a shit apartment and you're working like a dog and everyone's rude to you. You know, I'm sure some people in New York have a great time, but the grass is never greener. And it's just different shades of shittiness sometimes. And I think we were kind of ashamed of our upbringing because we were thought to be ashamed of our upbringing. As I alluded to earlier, we were the uncool part of Ireland. Like part of the reason we call ourselves Sons of Southern Ulster, which believe it or not in Ireland is considered quite contentious, because whenever you bring up the name Ulster, people think of, you know, what was called the Troubles 20 or 30 years ago. Sure. And people get very nervous about it. And but when we brought up the name, what we were saying was, you know, just a very quick history lesson. You know, the top corner of Ireland, the top third of Ireland, let's say, or quarter of Ireland, is British ruled. And it's six counties that are part of the ancient province of Ulster. And there's three other counties in Ulster, which are Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal, which Britain really didn't want. And because there was nothing there, there was nothing for them, there was no industry, there was no, you know, it was mainly poor Catholics and bad land and everything else. And the Irish government, in their wisdom, when they took over, they totally ignored these counties. There was nothing. There was just nothing. There were no amenities. There was no, if you ever look at a train map of Ireland, for example, there's no train that goes through southern Ulster. It's just barren. There's nothing. There was no industry. There was nothing there. And So both governments were very, they ignored this part of the country, and it was kind of looked down upon, and Cavan people were sort of known as, you know, being very mean and you know, frugal and kind of stupid. And so you were kind of brought up in this world that Cavan was kind of not the cool part of Ireland to live in. And that was kind of impressed upon you. Like I sort of talked about the culty thing versus the Dublin people like earlier. And yeah, that really was a thing. And the Dublin people would look down upon the country people. But the country people then, in their own way, would look down upon other parts of the country. So, you know, when you look at Ireland, you look at places like Cork or Galway, or, you know, whenever you meet an American person as an Irish person, you go, and they go, hey, you're from Ireland. And you go, yeah. And they go, I've been to Ireland, it's great. And you go, where'd you go? And they go, well, I went to Galway and I went to Cork and I went to, you know, they'll name these places. They never go to Cavan. Or they never go to Monaghan. And I kind of see why they don't. But there was just never any resources put in there. So I feel that that part of the country was sort of consciously ignored. And it wasn't cool to be from there. It just wasn't cool. And I think sort of part of the whole album or the lyrics and writing about it, part of it is kind of coming to terms with that part of yourself as a mature adult and going, fucking shit, there was a lot here that sort of we had at our fingertips that we didn't really know about, and it turned us into the people that we were. And as I said earlier, I totally resented moving to Cavan when I was 11 years old. Because I bought into the whole, I thought I was a dub and I was moving to this fucking hellhole. And so I bought into that whole thing. But now as I'm older, I'm so glad that I got to spend that time there, because it wasn't always pleasant. And there was a lot of boredom and it was a lot of shittiness and, you know, things you didn't have. But I'm just so glad it made me the person I am, for better or for worse. Many would say for worse, but, you know, it that's what it is.
Is that why you're raising your kids in Acton, for the art, for their future art?
Why am I raising my kids? And I do have to remind myself sometimes. I remember the reason I moved to Acton. I don't know if this has anything to do with the Sons of Southern Ulster, but my wife, who's much more intelligent than I am, let's say, we'd had our third child, and we lived in a house in Somerville that was the size of my living room now. And you know, we sort of thought, well, we've got three kids now, it's time to go. She's a school teacher too, so let's look at the school.
My wife as well.
Oh well, there you go. So we looked at the list, and Acton was the first town on the list. I didn't know anything about Acton, but I saw a house that I liked, and I said, let's go there, because I don't want to live in one of those suburban concrete bunkers, you know, those kind of houses. And it was the worst decision I ever made in my life. Not moving to Acton, but not moving into a concrete bunker. I bought a 200-year-old house instead. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Going back to what you were saying about Ulster, there's, you know, recently with, you know, Brexit and everything, there's like a kind of new push for unification of Ireland, which would reunify Ulster itself. Do you have any thoughts on that? Positive, negative, indifferent?
I've been here for so long that I'm removed from the situation. And if I grew up in Ireland, one of the things we're very conscious about, and I don't mean to sound wishy-washy here, but we're not one of the reasons some in the Irish media ignored us at the beginning was they saw this name and they just assumed that we were some sort of Republican band. And a Republican in Ireland means a different thing than a Republican here. It means somebody who wants the unification of Ireland. But I would say that growing up as a sort of a Catholic in Cavan back in the 70s, aspirationally, everybody sort of, all the Catholics kind of aspired towards the United Ireland. And I think as money came into Ireland and it became a more sort of a vibrant economy and people became more comfortable, I think that whole thing sort of moved into the background. And what happened, I think, was, you know, if you think of the north of Ireland back in the 20s, when Britain kept the north and they gave the south over, the north was where the money was. It was where the industry was. It was where the education was. It was where the sort of many of the gentry were. There were some in Dublin, but the north was a kind of an enclave of it. And what's happened over the last, I would say, 20 or 30 years, it's kind of changed a bit now. So if you go to Ireland now, I think you find that the south of the country is very progressive. And the north of Ireland is kind of like where the south was 40 years ago. They're very, they're not unlike some of the, how do I put this delicately? Some of those American evangelical types who, you know, there's that Protestantism and they're very, you know, they stand by it. And that's all died off in the south of Ireland. That whole religious thing, it doesn't really exist anymore. The church killed the goose that laid the golden egg with all that stuff that they got up to. And the south of Ireland went from being this really backwater place to being very progressive. And the north kind of, I think, stagnated. And I don't say this in any sort of, you know, triumphal way that, oh, and the south was better because I used to live there. I don't really give a shit. But now you've got these two countries now, or you know, these two territories side by side, and they're still quite different. But I think the writing is on the wall that at some point Ireland probably will be unified, because it's very clear that Britain, who the North who want to be ruled by, actually don't give a shit about them. And if I was a Northern Unionist, and the Unionists being the people who want to stay with, keep the union with Britain, if I was a Northern Unionist, I'd feel very, very betrayed by the British government. Because it's clear that they went into this Brexit argument or this Brexit thing without a plan for Northern Ireland. And I think there's a danger. I don't know how big it is, but I think there's a danger that they're poking a stick into a potential hornet's nest there. And, you know, I can't imagine that the current situation is sustainable economically, because now they don't even know where the border is. They've kind of borders in this middle of the sea, and it's absolute nuts. So I think economically, at some point, Ireland will probably be united.
Do you think that there's some connection between this like current tension, and I guess what I see is on the global scene, an explosion of Irish music, that especially kind of Irish alternative music, and I say explosion maybe in quotes, but there has been a lot of, like, I came across you guys by way of Fontaine's DC, who I'd seen a couple of years ago, and I think similarly trying to tell some stories, and they and in exploring them came across yourself and a bunch of other bands that seem to be making more of a global impact now with alternative music, and it seems like from all across Ireland.
Well, I think what you've got, like a few minutes ago, I was sort of talking about what it was like to come from Cavan, and how you always were kind of, you know, you were made to feel kind of belittled, and it was this shitty rump of the country. And if you look at the wider sort of world, Ireland was always like that. The Ireland that I grew up in was very, it was old fashioned, and it was kind of insular, and we were kind of viewed by, you know, the way Americans would view Ireland. Some of them still do. They kind of think you go back and it's lots of people running around in little Aran sweaters and you know, that kind of cliche that Ireland's this kind of country that's sort of still stuck in the 50s. And it's, I think, true. It's certainly not true. And it's a very progressive country now that money has come along. And I think what that's translated into is you've now got musicians coming out who have confidence that their forebears never had. Like if you look at U2, for example, and I don't have an opinion on U2, good, bad, or different, I don't really care. But if you look at U2, you know, very professional and very good at what they do. But it was always basically the American rock and roll model. Like there were times when Bono almost spoke with an American accent. And I think that speaks to a sort of a mindset or something, where there's just a lack of confidence. And I don't for a moment suggest that Bono suffers from a lack of confidence, but I'm just thinking that was the way it was. If you wanted to do something in the arts, sure, you had to kind of emulate it. You had to make it work with America. You had to make it work with Britain. Because I can tell you, when I was in the Panic Merchants years ago, I listen back now, and at the beginning of the Panic Merchants, I sang like an English person, like the guy from Green Day or something. And then
the first Green Day record, Billy Joe, just straight up ripping an English accent.
And I was kind of doing the same. And then when we kind of got into like bands like the Gun Club and stuff, and then I started singing like kind of an American accent. So everyone was doing this. And I think it's born out of this kind of, well, we're Irish, but nobody wants to hear our stupid shit. But I think there's a confidence there now that these younger bands, because they're a lot younger than us, like the Fontaines, they're full of self-confidence. They're absolutely filled with it. And they're not ashamed of who they are. They're not ashamed of the past. And they're not being forced to sort of be ashamed of the past. They probably haven't been, like they were born after the Troubles, and they were born after the church sex scandals, and they were born after kind of all that shit that was there holding people down. So these kids are full of self-confidence. And in some cases, there's too much damn self-confidence. Occasionally you want to tamp it down a bit. But I think that's why you're seeing this kind of very Irish kind of movement of these bands that are doing very Irish things. And they're looking to Irish. The striking thing about the Fontaines is they're looking to Irish influences, and their lyrics are very, you know, people say they're kind of Joycean and they're singing about Dublin and stuff. That really wasn't done in the past. Like the Pogues did it. But the Pogues, and I'd say this with all due respect, the Pogues were essentially an English band. They really weren't, you know, they were of Irish heritage, and Shane McGann was born in Ireland and stuff. I'm not trying to, you know, knock them in any way, but they were essentially an English band. Irish bands didn't really do that, except these kind of, you know, what would be considered like your parents' music, like the Dubliners and stuff, who were just brilliant bands, but they weren't considered cool. But now you've got like the Fontaines singing about Ireland. You've got a band called the Murder Capital, and I saw those like about this time last year in Somerville, actually, in once ballroom. It was the last
I was at that show.
And they were just, they exuded self-confidence. They were just fantastic. And then there's another band that was over here a couple of years ago called Lancome. And they do this traditional music mix. They're obviously all punks because they kind of have this drone thing going on. But they do this old traditional Irish music and put a whole new slant on it. So there's a whole series of these bands or musicians who are just so filled with self-confidence and happy about their Irishness and proud of it. And I'm not proud of it in that corny, shitty way of, hey, I'm proud to be Irish. But no, they have the confidence in their culture and in themselves that they can now sing about this stuff. And I just think that was not afforded to people in the past. And that's even for the better. Like, you know, Thin Lizzy. I love Thin Lizzy. But you could see Thin Lizzy and go, they're American. You wouldn't even know that they were Irish because that's what they did. You know, they were doing American rock and roll. And so I think, I think it's a testament to the new Ireland that, culturally it's way more expansive than it was. And people have sort of stepped out of their comfort zone. I was going to say they stepped out of their comfort zone. I think their comfort zone got bigger.
Sure.
And hear those Irish accents, those thick Irish accents now, so much more.
That's true. These bands that we're talking about, though, they're like singing or speaking in an Irish accent. They're wearing it on their sleeve, you know.
Some of them lay it on a bit thick, but
yeah, that's fair. I think that's.
Who's the band? Oh no, I haven't heard them.
Oh, nailing that genre, Dennis.
All right, here's the Mahawala, yeah. If you like that, you should check out Lancome because they're really good and they mine that stuff. And, you know, when I was a kid, the people who would be playing that kind of traditional music, they just weren't cool, as in they were all men in suits. And, now you look at Lancome and they're all covered in tattoos and pierced and stuff. And they're playing this music that our grandfathers used to listen to. And it's cool now. And it genuinely is cool. I'm not being, that sounds like I'm being sarcastic. They're genuinely very cool.
How do you spell that? I'm just curious. Lancome, like L-A-N-K?
L-A-N-K-U-M.
Lancome, thank you. I think I said this while you were talking and I apologize for interrupting, but I was at that Murder Capital show was the last show I went to before this went down. And the last like night where we went to that show, we went to a bar afterwards. I ran to a friend at the bar. We talked to people, found out that the NBA was canceled.
Yeah.
And like everything, that was like the day for me. So, and that was at our friend's once ballroom. So,
well, I took my son along cause he was a big fan of them. And yeah, he's only 15 or 16 and they've got a generous door policy. They let dads in with their kids at once. And they trust you. It's not like, you know, it's a nice kind of venue. So it was a great place to take them, but it was a great gig. I was shocked. And I'm not a great gig goer. I tend to go to even bands. I shouldn't say this, but I tend to see bands that I even like and get bored very fast. And that night I didn't get bored.
No, they put a show on. I mean, I don't remember the singer's name, but he was out in the crowd in people's faces. And I think I got the impression that they were used to bigger crowds overseas. And this was like,
I think they were hitting bigger crowds. And I think that was a small gig for them. And unfortunately, then that was the first night of their tour, I believe. And it all came to an end the next day. So that had to.
Yeah. Well, they'll be back, I'm sure. They definitely controlled that room for that night. That was really cool. We actually are on a beer podcast. I don't know. We haven't talked about beer very much.
Oh, yes. Well, I was wondering when you got to that.
we thread it in just so we spice it in. But I was in the course of reading through your lyrics, I just want to call out Baby Sham as something that I learned about from looking up some of the things I didn't understand in your lyrics. So that is like a Perry that was popular back in the day.
To say it was popular is
okay, available.
As I told you earlier, we had a pub, like a rough and ready pub, and it was basically men that would drink there. So you know, the heavy drinkers, the big spenders, the people you'd want to see coming in would be these men who would, you know, drink pint after pint. And occasionally on a Saturday or a Sunday night, they might bring their wife or their girlfriend down. And this sounds very sexist, but this is just the way it was.
Would they ever bring both?
No, they one or the other. So, all right. And Baby Sham was a drink that was specifically aimed at the female market. And it was in a very small little bottle, and it had a little deer on the cover, like a cute little deer. And it was like I'd say what it was really. You said Perry. I'm not sure what Perry is, but is that a pretend champagne?
It's a pear cider.
Yeah, it was. But it looked like champagne, and you would have, there was a special little glass you pour it into. So it looked really dainty. But I can tell you, in the 5 or 6 years we owned the pub, we probably sold like 2 bottles of Baby Sham the entire time. And in fact, I remember at one point opening a couple just to see what it was like. It was actually the perfect drink for a young kid who wants to start drinking to drink, because it almost tasted like apple cider or pear cider.
Right.
And it was quite refreshing. But it was definitely aimed at the female market, which was quite cynical at the time. And I think America used to have cigarettes like that. They used to have cigarettes that were sort of aimed at women. And
the Slims.
Yeah, so it was that, very much in that sort of vein.
Well, now we have alcoholic seltzers filling the same role in the United States for the craft industry. So we're
Slim cans,
right there with
you. Slim cans are marketed towards the ladies.
1,000% I am.
Yeah, yes, and it's terrible. And we brought, you know, it's even uncomfortable talking about it, because it's just so kind of abhorrent in a way.
Yeah, it's true.
But because even the ladies, as they say, they weren't interested in Baby Sham, as they say. We probably sold 2 bottles. And they didn't. And when somebody ordered a bottle of Baby Sham, they had no idea that it had been on the shelf probably for about 10 years. So it had a long life too, obviously.
Long shelf life.
Yes.
Especially in this last record, and probably because I have the lyric sheet in front of me, you have a lot of really specific beer references. We've got sour porter, or the smell of sour porter. We've got we got a kick out of newfangled lagers. They look the same going in as they come out, because we at Jack's Abbey make newfangled lagers.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, it kind of does look the same going in. Sometimes
that's true. That's true.
I mean, if you're dehydrated, I mean, you gotta hydrate up.
That's true. That's true. 1-to-1. That's, we practice 1-to-1 on this podcast.
Well, when we first bought this pub that we had, lager on draft was a luxury. Nobody had it. And then it sort of came in about, you know, the early 80s or something. All the pubs got harp lager on draft. So it was kind of the height of sophistication to have a, you know, you have to remember, this was back in the day when the biggest selling drink in our pub would have been the bottle of Guinness, not the, you know, the Guinness nowadays, it's like draft Guinness, but you know, that kind of Guinness, sure, that's just in a bottle. And it was warm bottles of stout. That was our biggest seller. So cold beer was like, it was looked down upon until the newfangled lagers came out.
I mean, I know it's slightly different. When I was in Scotland 2 years ago, finding cold beer still was kind of hard. Like, there's...
I was in Ireland in 2016. Yeah, like they still drink warm beer. Like you can get cold beer, but they're like, look at you funny, because they did.
Who wouldn't look at you funny, Dennis? Come on.
That's fair. That's fair. fair.
Well, a couple of years ago, I knew Ireland had changed when I was there about 10 years ago, and I was in this pub that I used to go to years ago. So it was a good pub. It was a good, reputable pub. And there was a guy there. He was probably about 19 or 20 with his girlfriend. And they were obviously on a date, and they didn't know each other that well. You could tell they weren't very comfortable around each other. And they were both drinking a Miller Genuine Draft, you know, that beer in the clear bottle. And you could tell that that was, at that time, that was considered very sophisticated. It had just made its way over. So we have it all now in Ireland.
You do. Yeah. When I was there, I met a guy, and I was just talking to him, and he's like the best beer that we get over here now, it's got to be Coors Light. It was like, oh man, oh come on. It's like, yeah, it's just light, there's nothing to it, it's great. It's like, oh come
you
on
you can drink lots of it.
That is exactly what I was gonna say. You can drink so many of those compared to I mean, I'm drinking a Murphy's on your recommendation, sir, and I think we are at 4% with the nitro in the can.
Yeah.
And this fills you right up.
Listen, I can drink 100 of these, no problem. All right. I don't know what your problem is.
Well, I should let you in on my little my shameful secret. Please. Is that I'm not a beer snob at all. And people are often, American friends are often disappointed in me because I'll often drink like Bud Light or something. And, so I'm really not a beer snob when it comes to beer, but I do like the Murphys when I'm sort of, you know,
not exactly. We're not here to be snobs about beer. We're just here to enjoy, you know, whatever you want to drink. We're going to.
No, I understand. About, you know? People are often disappointed. They seem to think that because I grew up in Ireland, that it's like, oh, I only drink dark beers. And it's, you know, I'll drink anything.
We aim to be a.
Even baby sham.
Come on, when's the last time you drank Baby Sham?
It's been a while.
We aim to be an inclusive podcast when it comes to all things here. So we actually, our last guest doesn't drink anymore. We spent a lot of time talking about non-alcoholic seltzer, Polar Seltzer from Worcester, Massachusetts. But I think the fascination for us is just, you know, we work in beer, we make beer and are involved in beer production. And we also, all of us make and love music and love that, you know, that connective tissue between the two. So, I mean, if you ever have a chance to have our house lager, and I, in fact, hope that we get a chance as a group in person to someday do this, since we are all local, that is an uncomplicated, simple, delicious beer that it is.
Oh, nothing, that sounds great.
Nothing fancy about it. Just
if we can get tailgaters over there in Acton to take in a keg.
Tailgaters. God, I gotta admit, I rarely head out to the pubs of Acton, or should I say the pub of Acton?
Sure.
I think there's two.
I think Acton could learn a little from Baileyborough, you know, get a few more pubs in there.
Probably a bit of middle ground. Yeah. Well, the thing is, when I go to Ireland now and I visit friends who live in smaller towns, like the equivalent of Baileyborough, the pub is still very much the hub of the place. And it's not just because everyone's a raging alcoholic. It's just, you know, it's a nice place to hang out. And especially in the smoking areas, which they banned smoking in Irish pubs about 20 years ago. So the pub owners built these extensive smoking areas that are basically just a new pub. And, you know, that just goes under the loophole. And it's the best place in any pub in Ireland to hang out is in the smoking area. Whether you smoke or not, it doesn't matter. And, you know, it's full of fans and stuff and heaters. So it's actually really comfortable. And because of the laws, they have to blow all the smoke out. But definitely if you go to a pub, you should hit the smoking area.
In between now and international travel, since you are a local to us here in Boston, where can you find a fairly... I don't want to say authentic, but a fairly good representation of the Irish public house culture in Boston? Where do you think does a good job of it? Besides Sligo, you know, big ups to the 12-inch TV in Sligo for Red Sox games.
Sligo always had a certain charm. Is Sligo still there? I haven't been in Times Square
It is still there.
I'll be honest with you, I very rarely venture out to pubs anymore. I would say it's been a lot. The last time I was probably in a pub is I spend a lot of time at the Cape with my wife's family. Have a house down there, and I'm more inclined to go to pubs down there when we're around. And around here, I really don't go. The Burren used to be, you know, a place I used to go to more than I should have, and spent many a night there. And that was very authentic, because it was owned by two Irish people, the two traditional musicians there. But to be honest, I don't really subscribe to the Irish pub. I'm not a big fan of it. And it's because I feel it's kind of inauthentic. I'm not a huge fan of the Irish pub scene, and I wouldn't sort of seek out Irish pubs. If I went to, you know, New York or something, I wouldn't be looking for, well, where's the nearest Irish pub?
Sure.
I think American pubs have their own culture, and it's a damn fine culture as well. And I think there's this kind of thing, well, they have to go to this Irish pub and get it, but they're kind of the same. And, you know, you go to the Irish pub and it's very much, you know, the menu is kind of hamburgers, and it's not that Irish really. And the other thing you have to remember about immigrants like myself, we left Ireland for a reason. We're not pining for sure. Pubs and things that sort of remind us of Ireland. So, you know, I'm because my kids are of a certain age, I just don't get to pubs that often. And so if I'm in Irish pubs, it's usually in Ireland, because until this pandemic hit, I'd head over, you know, for band stuff about two or three times a year. Of course, that's all stopped now. But so the last time I was in a good Irish pub, I'm afraid, was the Washerwoman in Killaloe in County Clare.
Well, dear listeners, the next time you were there, a stamp of approval.
It's an awesome pub.
It's a quick digression. I met a Swedish man at a brewery in the Netherlands, and we got to talking about beer, and it was a long and meandering conversation. And he told me that in his native Sweden, the bar that I would describe as an Irish bar from growing up in Boston, he said they call them Boston bars in Sweden, and they just have random stuff from Boston on the wall. So it's kind of like the pastiche of an American version of an Irish bar, but with like a Sam Adams sign and like a picture of like Fenway Park. And they're like, yeah, Boston bars. That's a Boston bar.
Yeah. And that used to be common enough in Dublin. They would have these kind of American themed, like there was a place called the Chicago Pizza Pie Company. And it had my sister worked there. So I occasionally went there, and it had one of the walls was, I'm aging myself here, but it was the Chicago football team, whatever they call it. I can't remember what they call it. But it had, when there was a guy called the Fridge.
Oh, sure. The Fridge. Yeah. The Bears.
And he was like, yes, on the wall.
The Bears. So
it was considered very sophisticated to go to those. And then for a while they opened about 15 years ago, I visited my sister in Ireland, and she kind of thought, well, Justin's kind of American now. We'll take him for an American experience. And they took me to Planet Hollywood. And if it's possible to be more depressing than Planet Hollywood here, which I've actually never been to, but I'm assuming it sucks, this was 10 times worse. And it was awful.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's still going. I think Planet Hollywood might not be a going concern in Dublin anymore.
I think that, I don't know
it
about Dublin.
Shouldn't it shouldn't be going anywhere.
It shouldn't. That's true.
Yeah.
But they're still out there, I think. I mean, who knows in the past year who will survive this. But
well, I think a lot of Americans like those places when they go on tour. And I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but it's sort of any city in the world. Like if you go to McDonald's, you kind of know what you're getting, I suppose. And although in Ireland at McDonald's, they do have a vegetarian burger. So
impressive.
Maybe it's not quite the same.
One of the I think we may have already done this, Oz, but you want to do the swing out question with
what Joe is trying to say is that we kind of wrap up our conversations with you, our guest, espousing, basically, you know, defending or telling us what your favorite beverage is right now. You know, as Joe said, it is a beer podcast. So defend your favorite drink.
Absolutely. Well, I, in knowing that we were going to be drinking beers during this conversation tonight, I did make the conscious decision to get this Murphy's Lager, as you guys all, or Murphy's Stout, I should say. And the reason I've always been fond of Murphy's, and I attribute it to the fact that I went to college in Cork, in University College Cork. And when people think of Ireland and think of Irish beer, they often think of Guinness and as the sort of the national drink of the country. But down in Cork, which is, you know, a cool part of the country, Guinness is certainly not the biggest selling drink. It's Murphy's, because it's made in the city of Cork. And I kind of went to Murphy's, or went to Cork, you know, not being familiar with Murphy's and being suspicious of it and being a confirmed Guinness drinker. But I have to say, my mind was changed. I think it's a smoother version of Guinness. It's Guinness is a bit sour sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think Murphy's is a little smoother. And if you want smoother again, there's a stout called Beamish. They didn't have it in the liquor store today. So I could stand by Murphy's, and like the guy who said earlier, he could drink it all night. I agree with him.
The guy being Dennis, our producer.
Yes. Good man, Dennis.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. I've not been able to find Beamish in, you know, in the States. But yeah, last time I went to Ireland, I drank probably
it's very smooth and it goes down easy.
Oh god, is it good?
And yeah, but that was a European keg, so
is that a bigger keg or a littler keg? I'm not sure.
Slightly smaller, but
because it's not imperial measure, it's in liters or something.
Yeah.
Dennis actually stumped for O'Hara's here. So before you came on, we drank some O'Hara's.
O'Hara's, yeah. It's Ireland's craft brewery.
Yeah, I don't think that was around when I would have been there. Like, the idea of a craft brewery was alien to Ireland when I lived there. And in fact, I ended up in one a few years ago after I'd had a few pints. And I sat at the counter and I asked for Guinness, and some kind of surly, you know, tattooed hipster kind of laughed at me, and you know, we only serve our own stuff. I left.
Do you think he would just bring you a stout to be like, here, we don't sell Guinness, but try this?
To be honest, I was a little intimidated by the whole experience, because you know, I'm used to it now, but you know, the idea of getting the beer list and you have to go through it and sort of pretend you know what everyone names and kind of go, oh, that one sounds good. And but I'm more used to it now. So if I ever go back there again, I'll be ready for that guy. He probably doesn't work there anymore. But
are you sure? You're just going to punch him in the throat, aren't you?
Well, that's what I should have done back then.
Well, that's not good hospitality.
Do you guys all play music together? Are you all in the same band? Or?
Kind of. Matt and I have been playing music together. And Dennis, we have not played music with Dennis.
I intimidate them musically, you know, so.
Too good.
Also, yeah. Just everyone plays a bass, so.
Yeah, also, I'm a bass player, so is Joe.
No, but those two are bass players. Yeah. I play the guitar, so.
Wow. What's the name of these bands so I can look them up?
Oh, well, they don't exist on the one that I'm playing, it doesn't exist on the internet yet. It's very new. It's pandemic related. Oz, you're in bands that you can find on the internet.
Yeah, my old band Pool House has some demos up. Grenades in the Archives is probably my thing that I'm most proud of.
Well, we can link those.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We'll send them your way. And I was being serious. I know I was in podcast mode for a second, but I do look forward to doing this someday. We'll have a brewery with a patio this summer. We're in the midst of planning it right now. Yeah. So we'd love to host you. And we're actually I don't know if you've got a chance to visit us before, but we're like a family restaurant. So you can bring your family out our way. We do pizza and full on.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'd love to check that out.
Yeah, we'd love to have you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And at some point when this shit is all over, we're sort of hoping to do a few shows over here, and we're not sure how we'll do them. We might do a stripped down thing with you know, a kind of an acoustic-y thing, because believe it or not, our music actually works quite well acoustically too, because it's it sort of allows itself. It's kind of ranty, kind of it allows itself to sort of be you know, we can do this acoustic-y thing. So we're not sure how we'd best do it over here, but that's the plan anyway.
Well, hell, maybe I'll drag these guys to Ireland, see you in Cavan.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't think Ireland's going to be open now for quite a while. It's
well, in the future, obviously.
So we were hoping to do something in the summer because there were a few like people from like these festivals and stuff that got onto us, and which never happened to us before. So it's typical bad timing, and now none of that's going to happen. So at this point, it looks like it's going to be next year. But we're trying to do the third album now. So
I'd love to know more about that. Maybe we have a chance for another conversation in the future too.
Absolutely. And I'll keep you guys posted. And when the Peeper Cat thing comes out, I can, I'll let you know. And
yeah, we're going to link to you. We linked to your Bandcamp earlier this week, but we'll link to it again. This is still very new for us. I think this will be our fourth or fifth episode we put out, but we've been, surprisingly, we've gotten a bunch of local folks who are, I don't know how big these people are in our minds. The people that we're talking to are people we've been listening to our entire life. So we're going to start to have a bigger following shortly. So I'll be excited to keep sharing your stuff. And
oh, that's all awesome. Absolutely awesome. Now this, and it's a great idea. It's very cool. It's very relaxed. I'm sorry I was late.
It's okay.
I totally misread the email.
That's fine.
I think we actually...
We actually made a comment about you saw the 7 to 8:30 and was like, does he think it starts at 8:30?
I must have seen the 8:30. That's what it was.
It's actually Joe's deduction there.
Yeah. Well,
because I think at like 8, we're like, should we just leave? And Joe mentioned that. And we're like, well, just stick to 8:30. Let's see if he shows up.
Yeah. I was just killing time here. And my kids were going in and going, hey, are you done? I'm like, no. And they're like, I don't know if you guys have kids, but when you're in this band mode, they couldn't give a flying fuck. They're just like, I'm still as uncool as ever. And they just think it's like, it's kind of like me going, hey, somebody actually wants to talk about my band. They think it's akin to like, you know, going to work.
Sure.
Or something like that. But I must get a copy of our latest vinyl version of the album.
Look at that.
Oh,
so I'll send a few of these to the address you gave me the other day.
That's very kind of you. We'll
if we can give you some beer for that, at least
beer money.
It's at some point, but let me get these to you because I've got a small amount of them and I don't know what to do with them. So,
well, that's awesome. That's very kind of you.
As the favorite way of collecting music is vinyl now.
That's true.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, well, it's prized for its inconvenience and its expense. And I gotta tell you, I don't know if you guys have put anything on vinyl, but it's a pain in the goddamn ass. Working with CDs is just so much easier.
Sure. You know what I did because it was super cheap back in the day was cassette tapes with a download because they were like a buck to make.
They seem to be back, but Jesus, I think that's a bridge too far for me.
Yeah, you gotta have way, way louder and less pleasant music to listen to be on tapes. It's all like noise and metal bands. Sorry, Dennis. Yeah. We talked a lot about cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes, though, are like literally just like buy this thing that you'll never use as a way to give an artist money.
Right.
Like, that's what they're for.
It's just cool.
I don't think anyone actually listens to them. And I've put away my cassette player. And I couldn't be bothered. And even the vinyl, I've kind of gotten kind of tired.
That's for me, at least like vinyl, I'll be like, I need to clean the house or do a task. I will put a vinyl on and crank it through the house.
Yeah.
Well, I sort of, my son has influenced me on the vinyl thing because I, up to recently, I was really good about buying vinyl. So if an album came out, I'd kind of go, oh, I'll get that on vinyl. And he'd go, well, why don't you just listen to it on Spotify? And I'd be like, no, I'll get it on vinyl. And the other day I read something about that Mogwai album, you know, the big Mogwai album is number one in the British charts or something. And I thought, I'm going to get that on vinyl. And I was online and I was about to purchase it. And then I just thought, fuck it, I'll just listen to it on Spotify. It's a lot of work. I know this isn't cool.
No, it's it's true. I personally, vinyl, as somebody who has a short attention span, forces me to listen to at least a side at a time. And I grew up listening to albums as albums, you know, and so there's like a you know, it's just a way to force my brain to do it. Cause otherwise if I'm on Spotify, I'm like, oh, that reminds me of this, reminds me of this. And I'm just,
yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I've hundreds of albums and I spend a lot of time listening to them, but buying new ones, I just find it difficult now because it's like, I'm jaded. I'm old and jaded. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for something to knock my socks off, and it rarely happens. You know?
Well, I like that new Mogwai album. I don't know if it's knocked your socks off. I think it's pretty.
It was good. I listened to it on Spotify.
Not me too. I didn't buy it yet. I also wanted to, and I'm looking at the cool book it comes with, and I'm like, you know, when I get the thing with the book and the insert, I look at it when I get it, and then I put it away, and then, you know, it's. I'm probably never looking.
Well, I'm the same. And then I have to keep the insert all nice and clean, and it's ridiculous.
Work.
There's something crazy about this whole music world, really.
Well, I want to say I appreciate your time and hanging out with us. It was really fun to chat.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening and for taking an interest. We appreciate it. I'll report back to the rest of the guys that we did this yesterday. Try not to make me sound like too big. Idiot, and
that's my job, don't worry.
Yet to fully understand the complexity of joy, of sadness, of loss, and of distance. Brothers and uncles, like cattle shipped off on planes and boat trains to Birmingham and Boston to build roads and homes with calloused hands. Sons of Southern Ulster, seeds scattered to the four corners to raise strange accented children, strange accented children. Long ago, in harsh tones, interspersed with spits and sips of powers and warm stout, the soft word of weakness, language littered with expletive. The put down, aimed and fired with the accuracy of a sniper's gun. And in the evening, when your breath sparkles like the stars, frigid black, black night, the silenced, solid, broken only by a plaintive moan from a cow or a distant bark. You can be all alone, thinking of unrealized dreams and of roads not taken. They didn't hug us or feel a need to tell us that they loved us. But in their hearts we rested on pedestals, coddled and adored with every atom. May they rest in peace wherever they may be.